Welcome to the Model Railroader, your ultimate destination for all things railroading. From trains.com, we bring you step-by-step modeling and construction projects, insightful reviews, tips from the experts, and more. This program is proudly presented by Aftersight, a community hub for audio news, entertainment, and resources. Find us at aftersight.org. This program is intended to be used solely by individuals who are blind or have low vision. All aboard!
Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine, read by Jason Consul. Today we will be reading the following articles: Step by Step, Kitbash a Railbus, and On Operation. The first article is Step by Step by David Karkoski. Do-it-yourself photo backdrops. Model railroaders have been using photos of prototype scenes to create realistic backdrops for some time. In certain situations, they can work well. I've successfully used them on the HO scale North American Prototype Modelers, or NAPM, layout in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, last featured in the March 2003 issue of Model Railroader. The photo of Tippecanoe Avenue on page 61 of that issue shows an example. However, there are several areas on the club's layout where prototype images don't work as well. The biggest challenges are perspective control and anachronistic content. It occurred to me that photographing a diorama where I could control perspective and content would yield good-looking background scenes for challenging locations. After a few test photos, I found that the continuity between the models in the diorama and those in the foreground made for a believable scene. Period vehicles, advertising, and figures can also be added or subtracted before the photos are taken. If you're looking to add backdrops to your model railroad, I hope you give the techniques outlined here a try. They've worked well for our club, and they'll look great on your model railroad, too. David Karkoski has been a member of the North American Prototype Modelers Limited, found at napmltd.org, club since 1994. He lives in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Step 1. Photography pointers. I used a digital SLR camera for this project. It's possible to take the photos with a wide-angle lens, a 24mm focal length, but the convergence of vertical lines can become more exaggerated, especially when working with structures. Also, distant objects get pushed farther away. A 50mm lens gives a view that's close to what your eye would see when viewing a scene, keeping objects in proper proportions. This is the focal length I prefer. Similarly, a telephoto lens, 120mm focal length, can be used for this project. However, you need to be mindful of the compression of distant objects into the foreground that happen with this type of lens. When taking photographs, avoid tilting the camera to get closer to the diorama. This exaggerates the convergence of parallel vertical lines. For those with a railroad built near eye level, the question of perspective isn't a significant issue. Your camera will need to be set at a height that's close to eye level. Those with layouts that have a lower benchwork level will need to decide if the background perspective will be at a normal viewing angle from above or from an eye-level perspective. I've found that lower elevation perspectives tend to look better. However, each situation is unique, and you'll need to determine what looks best to you. To aid in setting the vertical elevation of the camera, I fabricated a tool from cardstock with elevations marked in 3 scale foot intervals. I then centered the camera's viewfinder on the chosen elevation. Next, determine the camera's angle of view into the diorama. The viewing angle into the backdrop is based upon the foreground elements that frame the scene and force the viewer to look into it from a specific vantage point. It's also determined by foreground objects that recede into the backdrop, such as sidewalks. When taking the photo of the diorama, position your camera to this angle of view as a starting point, adjusting as necessary. Step 2. Editing and printing. After you've taken the photos, you'll need to crop and size the images using photo editing software. Cropping will affect the size of objects in the final print. To enlarge objects, do a tight crop. To reduce the size of an object, do a wide crop. Objects in the photo will need to be in proper proportion with the foreground items. A close crop producing an automobile that's 10% larger than a foreground vehicle will be obvious to viewers. The same applies to figures. Structures are more forgiving, but exercise care with windows and doors. I compared actual items in the diorama to the photographs to make sure they were at the correct proportions. The farther back in the diorama an object is, the smaller it should appear on the print. In the case of the project photos, an 8x10 crop seemed to reduce the correct proportions in the images. As shown in Figure 2, the crop can be a significant portion of the overall photo. You can also adjust the printer output to get a properly sized image. The software I used let me size the printed output and save it as a PDF. I started with an image sized to my crop and adjusted it from there. I then printed the PDF on a black and white laser printer to evaluate the results. Unfortunately, there is no hard and fast rule when doing this, as camera placement, lens, crop, and printing all affect the final image proportions. Be prepared to make several exposures and prints before getting what you want. Step 3. Practical application. On the NAPM layout, I had an area between two buildings to fill. It was about 40 inches above the floor. There are two possible viewing angles into the scene, as a peninsula extends out in front of the location. The perspective is only from normal viewing height. The foreground structures, when viewed from the left or right, created hidden areas on the backdrop photo. I wanted to take advantage of this to carry the wall of the left building into the background when viewed from the right, and to present a side view of another building when viewed from the left. To start the photo backdrop project, I made a sketch of what I wanted the final backdrop scene to look like. Then I made a plot plan of the diorama. Step 4. Diorama construction. I built the photo diorama following usual model building practices. Since this is a photographic set, most of the structures and scenic elements can be removed. First, I set up the structures and streets. Then I made a series of test photos to evaluate the initial placement, adjusting and adding details as necessary. Note that the red brick building in the far distance of Figure 2 is a photograph of a model. I now take elevation photographs of all my structures to use in creating dioramas or for backdrops. Step 5. Photographs and installation. I first chose a viewing angle that placed a large amount of the sidewall of the left-hand building in the photo. I was disappointed in the ability of the images to capture the appropriate blend of the wall on the left side into the foreground structure. The receding roofline slope on low elevation images seemed much too great. For the next series of images, I added more details and vehicles to the scene. I removed the second building on the left side of the diorama and replaced it with a tree. To correct the excessive slope on the roof, I made a series of exposures ranging from 6 to 36 scale feet. I increased the height of the camera for each picture using a viewing angle that looked down the alley to reduce the amount of left sidewall visible in the picture. When I reviewed the photos, the roadway appeared to rise into the background with each increase in elevation. On the right-hand view, as the roof line shifted up with the increased elevation, the ground line shifted up as well, resulting in a mismatch. I felt the 15 scale foot image best achieved my goals. The relationship between foreground and background was acceptable. I also liked the way the vehicles appeared. The slope of the roof line wasn't great, but I could live with it. I had the final image printed at a big box office supply store. The price was reasonable and the image quality was adequate for my purposes. I trimmed out the final picture and removed the sky. Then I attached the remaining image to the wall with rubber cement. I blended the foreground into the background and added details to complete the scene. This method of creating photo backdrops has proven effective for the city scenes on the NAPM layout. If you have a digital camera and photo editing software, you'll find this project easy and rewarding, allowing you to produce backdrops that complement foreground scenery. The next article is Kitbash a Rail Bus by Lou Sassy. Photos by the author. A Ford Model A rail stake bed truck served as the starting point for this On-30 model. When passenger traffic started to slow down in the early 1930s on our On-30 Sandy River and Rangeley Lakes, it was time to introduce a more frugal way of getting passengers to and from their destinations. Around the same time, I noticed a used Bachmann Spectrum Ford Model A stake bed rail truck listed on eBay. Converting the truck to a bus sounded like a good project to keep me busy and to keep passenger service a viable option on my 7x16-foot layout. After receiving the model, I test ran it on the layout. Satisfied with its performance, I took the stake bed rail truck over to the workbench to kitbash it into a rail bus. Kitbashing is a great way to get models that aren't otherwise available. Even if you don't model Sandy River and Rangeley Lakes Rail Bus Number 1, hopefully you can put some of these techniques to use on your next project. Step 1. Initial modifications. I started the kitbash by removing the plastic stake racks, bottom half of the rear differential, wheels, drive shaft, cab, engine compartment hood, driver's seat, and shift/brake levers. Then, I used a cutoff disc and a motor tool to remove the stake pockets. Wear eye protection when doing this in case the disc shatters. Since I didn't completely dismantle the truck, I cut a slot in a greeting card, set the model in the opening, and taped the edges. This kept metal shards out of the motor and electrical components. I also used the motor tool to cut away a portion of the rear of the cab. I filled in the stake pockets with 0.010-inch styrene, secured the die-cast metal frame with 5-minute epoxy. After approximately 30 minutes, I trimmed off the excess styrene and epoxy with a number 11 blade and a hobby knife. Step 2. Scratch building with styrene. The illustration in Figure 1 shows how I constructed the rail bus body. Except for the running boards, I used styrene sheet and strip for the body. First, I marked out the door and window locations on the 1/10-inch plain styrene sheet with the scale rule and sharp number 2 pencil. Then, I used a fresh number 11 blade and a hobby knife to cut out the walls and window openings as shown in Figure 3. Next, I used assorted widths of 0.001" and 0.015" styrene strip to create the doors and outer walls. Once the walls were built, I reinforced them around the inside perimeter with O-scale 4x4 styrene strip. Then, using a number 73 bit and a pin vise, I drilled a hole in each door for the handle. I pressed the handles, made from fine wire bent at a right angle, into the holes using pliers and secured them with 5-minute epoxy. The rear wall of the bus has 2 window openings. It's a laminate of 0.001" styrene sheet covered with HO scale 1x12 strip stock. The bus body is 6 inches longer than the truck bed. To account for this, I laminated 2 pieces of 0.60" by 0.125" styrene strip and attached it to the metal body with 5-minute epoxy. I beveled the bottom outer edge of the styrene to match the thickness of the truck bed prior to installing the piece. Step 3. Assembling the body. I attached both sides of the passenger compartment to the rear of the cab using 5-minute epoxy, making sure they both aligned with the top outside edge of the bed. Then, I attached the rear of the passenger compartment to the sides with plastic cement. Next, I added 2 braces, beveled on a sheet of extra fine sandpaper, to the underside of the 0.001" styrene passenger compartment roof to match the slight curve of the cab roof. Though not shown here, I also added styrene strip braces to the top of the truck bed to help keep the walls in alignment. I attached the passenger compartment roof to the back of the cab. I reinforced the joint with 60 thousandths of an inch by 125 thousandths of an inch styrene strip. This allows the entire roof assembly to be removed for access to the cab and passenger compartment. Step 4. Time for paint. With the body and roof assembled, it was time for paint. Well, almost. To separate the cab from the chassis, I first had to remove the enclosure for the solid-state circuit board. The front screw holding the sides of the enclosure in place is only accessible, parentheses, after removing the top, close parentheses, from the inside of the enclosure. It can only be reached from above. I again used a greeting card to protect the running gear and electronics while I primed the perimeter of the truck bed with Tamiya surface primer. I used the same product to prime the cab, passenger wall assembly, engine hood, and roof. Once the primer had dried, I sprayed the same parts with Tamiya Black TS-14. I brush painted the fenders and underframe Model Master Engine Black 4888, which is discontinued. MicroMark and Rail Center offer a similar color in acrylic. Even though I spray painted the body and underframe with an aerosol can, I wasn't able to cover every nook and cranny. I used a brush to touch up areas that I missed with the Model Master paint. To simulate a canvas roof, I turned to a piece of 2-inch wide masking tape. After attaching it to the model, I cut around the perimeter with a fresh number 11 blade. I painted the roof Model Master Oxide Red, or 4882, which is also discontinued. Instead of reinstalling the plastic engine cover, I wrapped the motor with a small piece of black electrical tape to prevent it from shorting out on the metal hood. Step 5. Weathering and windows. I did some preliminary weathering on the rail bus with dry pigments prior to installing the window glazing and reassembling the model. Applying the weathering first prevented the glazing from getting scratched and dirty. With the initial weathering completed, I cut pieces of 10 thousandths of an inch clear styrene sheet to size for the windows. I secured the glazing with a Lean's tacky glue. Though the glue comes out of the bottle white, it dries clear. The blinds are solid color pieces of 1940s magazine pages that I purchased years ago. I used the parchment colored piece for the bus. At this point, I set the driver's seat in place, reinstalled the driving mechanism, reassembled the bus, and installed the seats in the passenger compartment. Editor's note, see scratch-built seats on the next page. Scratch-built seats. The passenger section of Sandy River and Rangeley Lakes Rail Bus No. 1 required 7 seats, visible in Step 7. The 6 that flank the solid-state circuit board enclosure feature strip wood and styrene construction. First, I cut 1-foot square strip wood into 1.5-foot lengths for the seat bottoms. I then cut 1.5 by 2.25-foot pieces of 10 thousandths of an inch styrene sheet for the seat backs. The rear bench-style seat is a scale 5'0" long since it doesn't have to clear the enclosure. The original driver's seat was too high for the Artista figure I wanted to use. I replaced it with a seat made from 2 pieces of 10 thousandths of an inch styrene. I brush painted the seat's roof brown. Once the paint dried, I attached the seats with weld bond. Step 6. Running boards. Though I used styrene for most of the rail bus project, I switched to Northeastern scale lumber strip wood for the running boards. I made the vertical S brackets from HO scale 2x8s, notched with a number 11 blade and bent at 2 right angles. Then I placed the S brackets on a sheet of parchment paper attached to a piece of styrofoam. I used straight pins to hold the strip wood in place while applying weld bond white glue with a toothpick at the joints. The glue helps keep the bends at a 90-degree angle. The running boards consist of an HO scale 2x8 vertical and 2x12 horizontal. I stained the running boards with an India ink and alcohol wash. I painted the S brackets engine black and attached them to the running boards. Then I installed the assemblies under the bus with weld bond. Step 7. Finishing touches. To wrap up the railbus project, I installed two Artista figures, one in the cab and one in the passenger section. I had to modify the driver figure so he would seat properly. I secured both figures with weld bond. To protect the bus from a rear-end collision, I added switch lamps that I culled from an HO scale Caboose Industries high-rise switch stands. I cut the existing exhaust pipe where it bent to exit the rail truck. Then I ran a length of brass tube from behind the rear wheel to just beyond the back bumper, see figure 2 in step 6 above. With that, Sandy River and Rangeley Lakes rail bus number 1 was ready for service. The residents of Strong and Kingfield, Maine are excited to have a new option for riding the rails. The next section is on operation by Jerry Dietzick. Electric staff systems. Don't fret. Electric staff systems do not produce an instrument intended to prod reluctant employees. Now, forgive me for this dad joke, and I'll explain that they're a method of train operation uncommon in the United States over designated single-track lines. I'm glad that a reader prompted me to explore the subject because the possibility of layout applications takes shape. I ran across the term in a 1948 Delaware, Lackawanna, and Western employee timetable long ago. It made me curious, but I dismissed it as an oddity. Collecting information for this column surprised me with how extensively it was used elsewhere. Even more surprising, Australia's Transport Sydney trains relied on its use between Kiama and Bomaderry until 2014. Picture a station manager on the platform handing an electric staff to the driver of sleek, modern equipment under catenary. The system dates to Victorian England and an 1888 London and Northwestern Railway patent. It's a form of absolute manual block operation. Absolute means that only one train at a time can use a block. Manual means that signals are operated by hand. This includes operating an electric switch which controls a signal. By contrast, track circuits control signals in an automatic block system. Possession of a metal rod called a staff authorized movement in a staff block without the need for a schedule or a train order. After operators with interconnected machines at both ends of a block confirmed it was clear, a machine at the entrance dispensed a staff which the operator handed to a train's engineer. Only one staff could be removed from the system at a time. Only one train could use the staff block because the system prevented another staff from dispensing until the original staff was deposited in the exit machine. Following moves could be made because the machines contained more than one staff. However, a second staff could not be withdrawn and given to a following train until the first train's staff was placed in the exit machine. Northern Pacific relied on staff systems at Bozeman Tunnel, Mullen Tunnel, Old Town Tunnel near Tacoma, and Stampede Tunnel. Stampede makes an ideal example. Double track on both sides funneled down to 3 miles of single track through the tunnel between Martin and Stampede. Keeping traffic moving created a heavy train order workload. The staff installation in 1916 relieved this workload. It was so efficient that it continued in service until centralized traffic control replaced it in 1958. Dave Sproul, a Northern Pacific dispatcher retiree, observed that the staff system was, quote, a poor man's CTC, end quote, run by staff operators under a dispatcher's direction. Lackawanna's governed 2.5 miles of its Bangor and Portland branch in eastern Pennsylvania between Shops, a point in Bangor, and Martins Creek Junction. There, a conductor, not a staff operator, could withdraw a staff. However, typical of staff rules, an engineer wasn't allowed to operate the machine. The B&P installation outlasted NPs, remaining in service until at least 1966. Santa Fe, Southern Pacific, Milwaukee Road, and Great Northern also employed staff systems. I bet Rube Goldberg would envy staff machines. They were odd ducks that looked like a Toledo lollipop penny scale crossed with a pinball machine, search electric train staff instrument, and you'll see. Searching Sydney Trains End of the Line on Vimeo.com will delight you with a 17-minute documentary commissioned upon retirement of the Transport Sydney Electric Staff Installation. Who would sacrifice precious layout space to such imposing machines? However, Aaron Stenson replicates them on his Illawarra line layout with an electronic microcontroller design. It mimics a staff with a radio frequency identification, or RFID tag, that locks out another until the tag is tapped in when the train exits the staff block. His club is considering using the system to control movements in a helix. This appeals to me. It reminds me what Bill Darnaby said when I asked why he put an automatic permissive block section on his mommy layout. Quote, "Because I think it's neat," end quote. Is there any better reason? Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine, read by Jason Consul.
You've been listening to the Model Railroader, brought to you by Trains.com. That's TRANES.com, in collaboration with AfterSight. If you've enjoyed this episode, we invite you to visit our website at AfterSight.org for more audio editions and original podcasts. For additional inquiries or to contact us, call us at 303-786-7777 or email contact@aftersight.org. Thank you for listening.